Members, we don't have quorum yet, but I think what we'll do is we'll have Representative Sundin begin discussing his bill, and we can move it after we get the meeting called to order. Well, welcome, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got House File 2971. Do you move it now or after?
We'll move it when we actually call to order later. So if you want to just talk about your bill and then introduce your testifiers, and they can give their presentations as well, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thanks for the time to discuss this issue in front of the committee today. The state assessment of utility properties is not an easy topic, and I don't claim to be an expert at it at all. But what I do know is that we have a large tax case moving through the courts that will impact 17 counties across northern Minnesota, and we as a legislature need to prepare to act. As you'll hear from a community stuck in the middle of these lawsuits, local governments are afraid. Townships, cities, and counties play no role in the assessment of utility properties. They don't do the assessments, nor do they defend the assessment in court if they are contested. That's the state's job. Yet, even with this, counties, cities, and townships may be on the hook for tens of millions of dollars if the courts find that the state overassessed Enbridge Utility Company. The years in contention date as far back as 2012, and unlike the state, which can rely on the general fund to pay back refunds, counties have long spent the levy dollars, so they will be forced to either deplete reserves or raise taxes. For counties such as Carleton, these funds will negatively impact the negatively impact the county's reserves and may cause commissioners to eye levy increases. For counties such as Clearwater, the potential payback could be more than twice of what the county levy is. I know my colleague, Representative Keel, and others have also worked on this issue, and I'm very interested in collaborating with others to make sure that these communities aren't adversely affected and to make sure we as a state are doing these assessments in the most consistent manner going forward. Under current law, if the tax court determines that the market value of a property should be reduced, all taxing jurisdictions are liable for paying a pro rata share of the resulting refund. House File 2971 allows the taxpayer to collect a refund directly from the Commissioner of Revenue if the property is subject to the reduced valuation determined by the court was assessed by the state. This applies to utilities and railroads. This bill also appropriates an amount sufficient to pay the refunds from the state general fund. With that, I'll defer to my fellow testifier who can provide a better county angle on this issue.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. Well, before we move to your testifier, we are going to call the meeting of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee to order. And with that, I have the minutes before us from the last meeting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Lunan moves approval of the March 7th, 2018 minutes of the committee. Any discussion, any additions or subtractions or other improvements to the minutes as presented? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes from March 7th, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Sundin, and your presentation of your bill. Representative Marquardt moves that House File 2971 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. With that, Representative Sundin, your testifier, if he could introduce himself for the record, and then we look forward to hearing your testimony, sir.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Al Paulson. I'm the Clearwater County Auditor Treasurer. I started employment in county government in 1976, and I've had a wide range of opportunities with government. I was assessor for many years, and then I was a county commissioner, and I served three terms as county recorder. And 12 years ago, I was asked by some local taxpayers to run for the county auditor treasurer position, which I still hold today. My experience in local government has allowed me the opportunity to observe and enact many law changes and requirements. I have a handout to pass out.
Sir, so can the page get the handout and hand that out for folks? Thank you.
Thank you. Clearwater County, a small northern Minnesota county, is home to about 8,000-plus people. Many of our residents are elderly citizens on very limited and fixed incomes, and by one-income families, our minimum wage, I call the working poor. We also have the home of many farmers and loggers and the businesses that support these occupations. Clearwater County has levied for the needs of the county with careful consideration of the values provided at our county board equalization through our budgeting process and notifications of truth and taxation to our taxpayers. We have accepted utility values that are certified to us by the Department of Revenue, and then it's important to note that the counties don't set the values on utilities. These are the state's responsibilities, and these values are certified to the counties each year. Clearwater County, like most counties, budgets for expense, levies for the needs, and collects and spends those tax dollars on the needs of the county. So you can understand that through no fault of our own, we find ourselves on the sidelines looking at the Enbridge tax court case of five or more years of elevated utility values resulting from a 2012 Minnesota Department of Revenue formula change. Potential and worst case scenario for Clearwater County is a $9 million plus refund of already collected and spent tax dollars. If Enbridge wins its appeal, this refunds more than the county's annual levy. Clearwater County will face one of the biggest hits because it is home not only to the pipeline of Enbridge, we also have a tank farm in Clearwater County and a terminal near the city of Clearbrook. You can imagine how frustrated counties can be when your notification from the Department of Revenue on Minnesota Tax Court Appeals reads, "How does this impact your county?" It says, "This appeal could affect the values of certified to your county for Enbridge Energy Partners for the assessment and taxes payable to your county. A decision in this case could be binding on counties. You will need to consider what your next step should be, if any." In Clearwater County, where our levy is less than what the potential cost is going to be, are we going to be the first county to have to combine with another county or lose our designation as Clearwater County? We're people who live in Clearwater County are very proud of Clearwater County. We're the home of Itasca State Park and the headwaters of the Mississippi River. So there are things there that we are proud of, and we worked hard to do those things. I got to also remember that certifications to us by the state, county, by the state, and the county's levy, we collect and spend on budget expenses. We don't levy for reserves. Our county has always just collected what we needed to operate. We don't have any reserves out there. This is a very scary situation for Clearwater County. And because we do not carry reserves, we don't know how would we pay this back through no fault of our own if they win their appeal. I want to thank you for letting me speak to you, and I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Are there any questions for Mr. Paulson? I know he has to head back to Clearwater County and got work to do yet today. Is there someone that can talk? Mr. Paulson or Representative Sundin, talk through the handout that you provided. Can you kind of give us?
I can do that.
Mr.
These
Paulson,
the counties that are affected by the lawsuit, and if you notice, like Aiken County, their potential would be about 203,000. You keep going in Clearwater County, we're at 9,208,000 on page 2. Hubbard County is 1.1 million plus. Red Lake County is a small county. I'm not sure if that's in here. Yeah, Red Lake County, they're at $4 million, and they're a very small county with the same problem that Clearwater County has, is that utilities pay over half of our taxes in the county because of the huge terminals and state pumping stations in the counties. So this is a breakdown of those counties.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Members, this is an issue that we're going to be dealing with into the future as we learn more about the lawsuit and what comes out of that. Could you, and I don't know if I heard the specifics, so began in 2012, the utilities are still being valued the same today as they were during that time. Is that correct? And then,
actually, I can tell you, in Clearwater
Mr.
County,
Paulson,
the utility value certified to us were $98 million more than last year for payable 18. So they keep continuing to climb. It's a hole that gets deeper and deeper, and there has to be a way of slowing that process down until these values are met or something, because it's just a, it's like a hole that we keep digging, and we, there's no way we can catch up to that. And
so, Mr. Paulson, when will, not until the court case is complete, will that be adjusted? Is that correct?
Correct, and I believe that's going to be in mid-June, I think.
We hope, yeah. And June of this year.
Yeah.
Right, but then there could also be appeals after that as well. So.
Okay. Members' questions? Anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Mr. May. Thank you, Mr. Paulson. I don't know if you're going to stick around for the rest. Okay, thank you for doing that. Welcome, Mr. May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom May. I represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, and our association does support the House File 2971 for the reason that of the possible impact it will have on the counties involved and the fact that our assessment officials are not involved in the valuation process. It's strictly a state-assessed valuation.
Thank you, Mr. May. Questions for Mr. May? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. May, did I hear that right? It's the state is the one that assesses these, not the local assessors. So basically the local counties are being affected by something they have no control over.
Mr. May.
That's correct. We're not involved in the valuation.
Thank you.
Mr. Claxton, are you here? Would you like to speak? Thanks. Welcome,
Ms. Rowley.
Ms. Rowley, thank you.
For the record, my name is Cynthia Rowley. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Revenue. I'm here with my colleague, John Klexim, who is Acting Director of Property Tax. We're here to provide a brief update about state-assessed property and information about current litigation. In addition, we'll briefly touch on legislative changes made last year that will impact how appeals are administered.
Again, for the record, my name is John Klotzim.
Welcome, Mr. Klotzim.
Thank you. The state values large integrated interconnected systems comprised of many different types of property operating as a unified economic unit. Some examples of state-assessed property are electric companies, gas distribution companies, gas pipeline companies, and fluid pipeline companies, and also railroads. These are complex properties and have rules and statutes that help guide the valuation process. When we have explored with counties whether they would like to value these properties on their own, we have received feedback indicating that the offices of the county assessors do not have the expertise required to value these complex properties. Today, we are sharing information about tax court appeals and to the valuations performed by the state. We expect that a taxpayer's opinion about a property's value may differ from that of an assessor or the state assessor. Companies subject to the department's valuation have obligations to their shareholders to maximize revenue and reduce costs. If a potential reduction in value outweighs the cost of an appeal, this is a business decision for them. Appeals to tax court do not mean that the assessors, local or state, are wrong in their valuation. There is a natural tension in the interest between assessors and companies.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Rowley.
Thank you. To give you some context about the numbers of appeals, we want to share with you some statistics about our appeals dating back to 2008. The state assesses the property of about 160 companies. Some years there are more, some years there are less. That means since 2008, the state has performed about 1,600 valuations. Of those, 1,532, or 96% of the valuations, were not appealed. 23 companies have appealed 68 valuations to tax court. Some companies appealed a single year. Others appealed multiple years. Of the 68 appealed valuations, no case has received final judgment following trial since 2008. Two companies' cases involving eight valuations have been tried in tax court, and one of those with the Supreme Court. We'll talk more about that one case in a moment. There are open tax court cases on 28 valuations, and the remaining 32 valuations have been dismissed or settled. Although no case has received final judgment following trial since 2008, you might be aware of a decision by the tax court that was published last spring. The case is Merck. We can provide you with some public information about that case, but because that has not reached final judgment, we cannot otherwise comment on the specifics of the case or any other active litigation. So to talk to Merck, Merck appealed 5 valuations of its property to tax court for assessment years 2008 through 2012. Merck's opinion of value reflected a 36% net reduction. That case was tried, and the tax court's initial order was appealed by both parties to the Minnesota Supreme Court. The Minnesota Supreme Court published an opinion and remanded the case back to tax court. Tax court issued its order. As directed by the Minnesota Supreme Court, tax court further explained its ruling. Merck then appealed again to the Supreme Court, and the case will be considered by the Supreme Court without oral argument. This is not the only possible outcome, but if the Supreme Court upholds the values determined by the tax court, it will result in refunds as well as additional tax owed by Merck. Overall, it would result in a net 7% reduction in value.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cloxy.
The 2017 tax bill included improvements to the administrative appeal process for state-assessed property. Before the 2017 tax bill, the law allowed a company to file an administrative appeal with revenue. As a result of the appeal, revenue may reduce the valuation. Then the company may agree to the reduced value in the administrative appeal and then still seek further reduction through a tax court appeal. The new law, effective for 2018, makes property tax appeals more like appeals of other tax types administered by revenue. If revenue and the company reach an agreement on value during the appeal process, the agreement is final. That means a final value could be reached before local jurisdictions calculate the tax. If revenue and the company do not reach an agreement on value, the company may still appeal to tax court. We are working hard to make sure the new administrative appeal process works well for all parties with the new changes. And with that, we'll stand for questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Cloxy and Ms. Raleigh. Mr. Cloxy or Ms. Raleigh, so the change from last year, at least on its face, it appears will reduce the amount of litigation in the future, the back and forth between the Supreme Court and the Appeals Court. Is that what we're anticipating? Ms. Raleigh?
Mr. Chair, it is our hope that we will be able to reach an agreement on valuation with companies in enough time for counties to, if there are any adjustments, to redistribute the levy and reduce cases in court.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, this seems to be a problem that is with us, counties and the dark stores, things like that, too. Just wondering, if a company decides to appeal their assessment or valuation, is there a cost to do that, or it takes a lot of time by folks on both sides of this process? What's the cost factor for companies and for the state as well?
Mr. Cloxing.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So there would be the initial filing fee for the company, right, and then any attorney costs that they have in pursuing that appeal. And those costs, as far as attorney costs, for the Department of Revenue were represented by the Attorney General. So there's the costs associated with defending that valuation in court.
Other questions? One question I have is so the clock is running on this, and we've got kind of the same thing happening. There's anticipation that these properties are overvalued. What can the counties do to mitigate their losses in the future? Is there anything, I don't know if Mr. Paulson would want to weigh in, but, I mean, can the counties, obviously, the conservative in me says you guys could pile up some cash and reduce spending and hang on to some of that revenue. But Mr. Hilgart's here. Maybe he can give us what are counties doing to mitigate losses in the future, Mr. Hilgart? Welcome, Mr. Hilgart.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgart, and I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I would also defer to Al Paulson if he'd like to come give his particular reference, but what we've heard from counties is that it's a combination of their levy is already tight enough, and that they're acutely aware that raising their levy means increased property taxes, or that they're raising it a little bit and keeping reserves, increasing their reserves in anticipation of a potential payback. However, it's important to note that some of the cases that you see in your Excel spreadsheet, the potential payback is multiple times their entire levy. So the capacity to pay back differs county on county. I mean, if you look at a larger county like St. Louis with a broader tax base, they might have a little bit more flexibility in this, but it is still an extreme hit and requires counties to either pull from services, which we are limited to do so since we are mandated by the state to do a lot of these services, or increase levy. And so the notion that it's just as easy as increasing levy, I think committee members are well aware how, unrightfully so, the legislature and the general population are always watching our levies, right? And so we are trying to tread that delicate balance of keeping levy lows while also doing our best kind of financial prudence to try to prepare for a worst-case scenario. And the last, I would comment to one thing the department has said in the case that counties don't want to assess these properties themselves. I would say that's an absolutely fair statement. We don't have the capacity. We didn't write the rule, 8100, which is the rule that I think is 20-plus pages, and it includes terms like economic obsolescence and others. Our assessors are in no place to be assessing these very complex properties, nor do we have the litigation teams or expertise or the Attorney General's office to rely on to defend those assessments. So I would just say I think it's completely appropriate that the state do these assessments and that counties don't have the capacity to do that on a one-by-one basis for all Minnesota's 87 counties.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, to your question of what can you do to mitigate this in the future, it would seem to me logically that any of the property taxes that are levied against these entities are ultimately paid by the end user of the utility for the product that they serve. So with that in mind, one way you could probably get away from this and would be reforming the system is to get away completely from assessing these properties in terms of an assessment value and move more to a franchise fee or something that you know, basically would create a indisputable type of levy for those pipelines or other utilities being there. So, I mean, that's something you could certainly think about. I would think that it would be good to do such because if the fee were fixed basically to cover the costs if there were emergency services or fire going to a pipeline or whatever like that, that would ultimately lead to lower utility bills in the future. And if the county needs to levy more money in the future, the savings really would be again delivered on the residents or the user in there. And it certainly would enfranchise the voters to either support or not support a levy increase that the counties are spending. So maybe that's something we should look at in terms of how revenue is collected with regard to these properties. It seems to me that the property owner is paying property taxes, you know, above ground, and I just find it interesting, you know, going back more than 5 years ago and first coming and serving on the property tax committee that these properties are paying quite a bit of money to counties. So if you got away from the whole valuation system, there would be no litigation in court.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Representative Rurick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Mr. Hilgart, if I'm looking at this correctly for the counties as well. If the pipelines were to win this case and their values would be reduced. Everyone else will see an increase in their property taxes to make the levy happen. So it'll actually be doubly hard for the counties to pay back what is owed, because everyone will already be seeing an increase. Is that correct?
Mr. Hilgart.
Chair Jaskowski, Representative Rarick, that's my understanding as well, that it would be a payback or refund payment as well as a future property tax shift if the values are reduced.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. With that, Mr. Hilgart, earlier I was talking about not increasing the levy but actually reducing spending. And I know the counties continue to say that we provide all kinds of mandates, and unfortunately we provide too many mandates, and I agreed, but certainly that's an option if there's the ability for them to do some of that. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, or I'm not sure who can answer this question, but in this bill, or maybe research can answer this for me. So I have a lot of utilities and pipelines and railroads in my district. Are we kind of opening ourselves up to a Pandora's box for future litigation with this, if we approve this bill moving forward, and more companies are going to come out and challenge these, seeing that the state's going to pick up the difference moving forward? I mean, I guess that would be a concern of mine, having a lot of these types of properties in my district.
Representative Frankie, was that a rhetorical question? Representative Sundin, Mr. Hilgart, anybody want to take a stab at that?
That's clearly not the intent of the law. This law is just purely to protect the counties.
Okay. Quickly, Mr. Hilgart, we got to move to the next bill here soon, but do the counties have an opinion on what's happening here? Are the utilities being more aggressive, as Representative Frankie is suggesting, or is the department struggling in their capacity to assess these properties properly? Is it some of each? What's your opinion?
And Mr. Chair, members, I think we're trying to, not to try to strike a middle ground here, but I think we're trying to assess that ourselves, and I have to give the Department of Revenue credit for trying to be as transparent and communicative as they can. While they're still in litigation, they have reached out to our counties. They're trying to communicate as best that they can while they're still in litigation. We're hearing from one side that, parties are being taxed too much. We're hearing from the other side that this is just the course of business, and it's in their interest to see if they can't reduce their taxes for the low price that it costs to Representative Anderson point to petition it. I think that from the Association of Minnesota Counties perspective, we're just looking for stability. You all are very familiar with your local governments, your county commissioners, and how volatile levies can be and budgets are, especially in smaller communities. And so what we're hoping for is just stability moving forward. And to the best that we can do that, whether it's a study of our current assessment procedures or the current rule or how other states do that, I think AMC is very interested in just getting more information to see how we might make this system a little bit more consistent for the future.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Anyone else who would like to testify? Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Representative Sundin, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I just encourage everyone here to go home if you have contacts in those 17 counties affected, and have a discussion with the county auditor or the county board as to the impact of this case moving forward and the potential impact of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. Thank you for bringing this important topic forward for us and a good discussion today. With that, Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 2971 be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, we're going to move to Representative Anderson's bill, House File 3297. Representative Barr moves that House File 3297 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'll try to be brief. I know that you have a busy schedule on your agenda. What this bill does is this was an issue that was brought to me by a constituent. Her mother had passed away on June 3rd, and by June 3rd, of course, she had not received her property tax refund. And you only get the property tax refund if you are a surviving spouse or a surviving dependent. As the law says, you can't have that be as part of her trust, her estate, So her four siblings who received then the estate were not eligible to receive the property tax refund that was owed to this woman. She had about $1,300 that was coming her way. This changes the law to make it so that this would any trust would also be able to receive the property tax refund in addition to the surviving dependents and surviving spouse. And that's the bill in a nutshell, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Members' questions for Chair Anderson. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, this is permissible, correct?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erickson. Let's see.
This says may file the claim and receive relief.
Correct, yes, that is permissible. Yep.
Other questions? Mr. Cummings would like to testify. Anyone else out here would like to testify in this bill? Okay, Mr. Cummings, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I know that Representative Anderson and we share strong values of having a good, transparent, and well-run government, and sometimes we don't agree on everything, but today there is firm agreement.
Wait.
Wow. Somebody got a camera?
Mr. Chair, under current law, only a surviving spouse or dependent may file a decedent's property tax refund. If the decedent files a property tax return prior to becoming deceased, but before the refund is processed, only a surviving spouse or dependent may receive the refund, as talked about. Some have recollected from our department that the legislative intent was to be able to provide relief to those trying to stay in their homes, which made this limitation make sense. Yet, we've heard from family members trying to pay for the costs of cleaning up a home of the deceased or for funeral costs. Our taxpayer rights advocate hears about this issue regularly. So we see a real issue here that could be made better. We thank Representative Anderson for bringing this bill forward. It would make a difference in the lives of many Minnesota families just at the time they need it the most. If this bill moves through the process, we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson and staff, and we appreciate the opportunity to be a resource this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, so if this were enacted, would there be something on your website, the Department of Revenue's website, that would indicate under the Property Tax Division that this is available?
Mr. Cummings.
This kind of relief, because I read may as permissive, and I'm not sure if that's how you interpret the verb may, but when I see may, it's permissive from an English teacher's perspective.
I think Representative Anderson, it is generally permissive. I mean,
yes. But anyway, I want to know if they're going to cite anything on their website.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, it is likely that in sort of our overall guidance that we have related to the property tax refund for our taxpayers, that this would be included in that.
Okay.
The other thing, Mr.
That long
Chair.
List.
Yes. I mean, we would also be talking to many of the people that work on our phones, in our phone room, also our taxpayer rights advocate, and other general resources so that people will know that this is available.
Thank you, because that often happens that this gets missed.
Right.
And then you have the repercussions and you don't need them. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
I'll pass. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering how this interacts with the senior deferment and also if taxes are prorated, like if the decedent dies halfway through the year. Just wondering.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, so if we're talking about the senior deferral program, there is a they enter into the program. They have to meet certain requirements in terms of having enough equity in the home. A lien is likely placed in the home. If that person were to die, then they would have to ensure that they pay the property tax that has been deferred.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin, you're good. Anyone else? Representative Joaquin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just wondering about the prorated question, too.
Yeah. Mr. Cummings.
If the decedent died halfway through the year? Would they get the full refund for the full year or just the partial refund?
Mr. Cummings.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I can defer to staff, but I believe that the property tax refund is for the previous year, and so this would be a refund for... It is not. Joel Michael is telling me no from behind me.
Mr. Michael, you... Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, the in the case of a homeowner's property tax refund, it is actually a refund based on taxes payable in the current year. But once that property tax statement has been issued, essentially that liability is out there, and if the claim is made, if the person's still alive at the time that the claim is processed, the claim would be paid, and if the person has died previous to the claim being paid, it would not be paid. So it isn't related. So there's no situation where you would prorate it for the part of the year.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Other questions? Any other testifiers? Oh, we do. Representative Anderson, I'm sorry.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. This is kind of along the same line. This is a common sense bill, but just wondering, does a claim have to be filed by the person before they die, or could their personal representative file the actual claim for the refund?
Representative Anderson?
I think Mr. Hines could comment on that, but as I understand it, it's for the previous tax year, so they would still have to be alive to file it for the previous, but Mr. Hines, correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair, we were having a conversation. Could you repeat that?
Representative Anderson.
Oh, okay. Just, again, it's a common sense bill, but just a timeline. Would the actual claim for the refund have to be filed by the person before they passed away, or could the actual refund claim be filed by their personal representative?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, if this bill were to pass, the claim could be filed by the personal representative. Yes. And a clarification to the last question. In the case of a renter, the refund is really for the rent paid in the previous year. But my answer would still be that if the person was entitled to it at the time that they passed away, they get the refund for that previous year. And there's no proration in that case either.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings.
One of the things that we've typically heard at the department is that a person will file for it, and they may not receive the refund, the property tax rate. You know, they may file for it in February or March, and they won't get it until August, you know, and when these are able to go out. And so things happen within that time period. So that's the majority of the items that we're hearing, that the person that is deceased or prior to their death, they did actually file it, but they died within the 5 months in between.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Representative Hertos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, how often does this happen, do you think?
Mr. Cummings.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertos, I don't have any specific statistics on how many times this happened, but we do typically hear this maybe two or three times a year from the taxpayer rights advocate or our phone room. And so I don't think that this is incredibly common, but there are situations at the department in which people are in sort of difficult parts of their life, and they're trying to read a statute, and then they're finding some absurdity. Oh.
It's revenue estimate.
There was an average annual approximately 3,500 returns where the refund was not paid to the death of the claimant with no surviving spouse or dependent.
Mr. Chair. Hmm.
That revenue note.
Mr. Chair.
So that's a big handful.
Ms. Schill has a comment.
Mr. Chair, Mr. and members, Mr. Cummings reading from the revenue estimate that you have in your packet, and that 3,500 returns is from a period of 2014 to 2016. So it's over 3 years. And then if you read down further, the average refund from these returns is about $900. And so that's where you get your revenue impact starting in fiscal 2020.
So, Ms. Schill, I don't want to overrule you, but it also says it's an annual average over that three-year period. Anyway.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Schill? Correct. It's 3,500 returns.
That never happens, members. Okay. Other questions, comments? Representative Anderson, closing comments?
Well, Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of feel like I'm having a George Costanza moment, and I should just quit while I'm ahead. So thank you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Barr renews her motion that House File 3297 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Schultz. Representative Nelson moves that House File 2956 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Drozdowski and members. Thank you for hearing this bill, House File 2956. I'm Representative Jen Schultz. This is a bill to exempt property tax payments from a senior living facility in Duluth, Minnesota. And this is a unique facility. In its first 95 years operating, it did not pay property tax. And I'm going to have the Executive Director, Scott Johnson, give you a little description of the facility and why they're seeking property tax exemption.
I don't have that. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Scott Johnson. I'm the Executive Director for St. Anne's Senior Residence in Duluth, Minnesota. Our roots in Duluth run really deep. We've been there for 130 years. Our first 10 years, we were owned and operated by the Benedictine Fathers of Collegetown, Minnesota, as a hospital. That training and teaching hospital had a mission for taking care of the impoverished and the poor. They outgrew the facility, which became St. Mary's in Duluth and eventually the Essentia Healthcare System. We then spent the next 10 years of our history as an orphanage under the Benedictine Sisters of Duluth. That, again, went for about another 10 years, and they outgrew their facility again, and that then sprang to another nonprofit in Duluth, Woodland Hills, which is a residential program for youth. From approximately 1909 to the current day, we have been involved in senior care. We have provided housing, shelter, food, and health care services to everyone as they come to us. So our mission over all of those years has always been to care for whoever it is that we receive, whether they're the most impoverished in our community or the most wealthy. We have lived to that mission for all of the decades and had been, as Representative Schultz was saying, tax-free until March of 1980. In March of 1980, there was a revision to the Minnesota Tax Code that, one, allowed for taxation of low-income housing. I refer to that day as when we got thrown under the bus. And secondly, there was a revision to what was tax-exempt in senior housing. It is probably the only part of tax exemption law involving a vulnerable population that specifies licensure. So if you look at exemption for children's services or mental health services, you won't see anything really in regards to specific licensure. Regarding seniors, though, the tax exemption was for Medicaid certified programs only, which was defined as nursing homes and boarding care. In 1980, that was probably relevant. None of that works that way now. There's been moratoriums on those licenses for almost the past 40 years, so even if you wanted to go down that road for auto tax exemption, you could not. Our facility is what you would consider an assisted living. We have multiple licenses to basically accomplish the way that we carry out our mission. We have a housing with services license. We have a restaurant and hotel license to deal with our kitchen and our room rentals. And then we have a comprehensive care license, which is part of the assisted living component with the state of Minnesota that's relatively a new concept. And we carry out our mission through those licenses. However, we're handicapped in the fact that none of those are identified in the tax exemption law. Even though of our 501c3 independent nonprofit status on a federal level. We contribute to our community. We absorb cost of seniors that can't afford to live in our facility. The number of vulnerable adults that are impoverished that come to us has increased to almost 40% of our population. We lose approximately $407 a month per each resident that's on any kind of government program, mostly being elderly waiver or HUD. We are a unique HUD-specific project as well. Those amounts that we contribute back and absorb by our organization, just on those two factors alone, is about $293,000 a year. And it's with elderly waiver and in our nursing care services, that pays about 52 cents on the dollar. We lose about another $72,000 a year in absorbing the cost for our seniors that can't afford to reside in any other kind of facility than ours. So we contribute back heavy, far in excess of the $82,000 we pay in property taxes. I guess in summary, when I look at our place in our community and the 130 years that we've served Duluth, I really don't believe it was ever the intention of any lawmaker to tax the St. Anne's. For most of those first 95 years, our place was staffed and operated by a cloister of Benedictine sisters that lived and worked and operated our facility. And then in more modern times, of course, as a modern 501c3 tax-exempt organization. And I kind of like what you said about some things being a common sense bill. I see this as that. So thank you. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, can you outline again the licensure conundrum that you're in?
Certainly.
In 1980 and what and how that worked again.
Certainly. In 1980, when we were predominantly staffed by the Benedictine sisters, I don't know what the license would have been. It would have been some kind of housing license, I'm sure. They went about serving the community and serving their mission, taking care of whoever came. The licenses that would have been available would have been a nursing home or a boarding care. And a boarding care facility is kind of like a pre-nursing home kind of license. Both of those are Title 19 Medicaid provider-type licensures, and they both have had federal moratorium on them since the 80s. So our facility has kind of morphed and changed by what was needed and what was available to continue mission.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. You mentioned $82,000 of property taxes. I'm curious if you could share approximately what is the property valued or assessed at, and do you know, or maybe Mr. Hines would know because we don't have our classification charts in our folders, but what class of property is this categorized in?
Mr. Johnson?
I have some documents. Let's see what I can see. I believe we are assessed as $4.8 million worth of building. And excuse me, the second part was classification.
Yep.
We are homestead inclusion, taxable market value, apartments, low-income rental. That's how we're classified.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, would that be the 4D classification?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, the low-income rental that he referred to would be the 4D. Was it also part of an apartment, which would be the 4A?
Mr. Johnson?
I'm sorry, excuse me. Yeah, our building is all apartments. It's 167 of them.
And
so, Mr. Hines.
And would they all be low-income apartments?
Yes.
Mr. Yeah. Johnson.
So then it...
Sorry.
Excuse me. I think then it would all be 4D, it sounds like to me.
Thank you. Representative New and then Representative Loeffler.
I guess I was done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question might be directed to you, Mr. Hines. I'm just curious. Do you know where other assisted living facilities would fall? And not only what would their classification be, would they be classified similarly? And also, do other assisted living facilities receive any sort of property tax exemption?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I I believe that the other assisted living facilities generally would probably be more likely to be in the apartment classification unless they are limited to low-income only populations, and those might be in 4D. And I don't really know, sort of in the broad scheme of things, where they likely fall. I don't know if Mr. Clockley might be able to provide any further information on that.
Mr. Clockseam, yay or nay? Thanks. Please do. Mr. Clockseam.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines is correct. If these qualify for 4D, that portion of the property that qualifies for 4D class would be classified that way. It's likely the rest of the facility would be classed as 4A apartments. If for some reason there's a part of the facility that has dining facilities open to the public, it's possible that the assessor may classify that portion as commercial. But likely the entire facility is class 4A apartment.
Thank you. Representative New?
And then just the second part of that question, do we know if other assisted living facilities throughout the state receive any sort of property tax exemption?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I would think generally that they do not.
Representative New? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just like to suggest that we have the Department of Revenue or our staff connect with the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services just to kind of better understand what kind of a precedent we might be setting, because I do believe there are others that are in the same situation. And we have more assisted living facilities than we have nursing homes across the state. We actually have more than the national average dramatically. And so we just need to make sure that this history is unique compared to others, or at least understand if we really are potentially looking at changing the whole classification, which I think has, you know, pluses and minuses. I think these people, our assisted living, clearly struggle to serve people on elderly waiver and MA, but we just need to go in understanding. It doesn't sound like the history on this one is all that unique in terms of what they're doing right now. You know, they may have a unique history going way back 150 years, but in terms of the services and the housing that they're providing right now and the people they're serving, if only 30% are occupied by persons under 50% of the median family income, that there would be a lot of them that would qualify for that, I think. But we'd really need to get some data.
Thank you. Mr. Hines has some.
Mr. Chair, there are actually two other facilities specifically exempted in statute this bill would be doing, for facilities that look like they're both in Minneapolis that use a lot of the same conditions in Representative Schultz's bill about the at least 30% of the units occupied by persons whose income is less than 50% of median family income. Those are similar, and other similar criteria as in this bill. Said one is in, I think they're both in Minneapolis, by limiting them to first class cities over 350,000. So specifically, the legislature has exempted these two other facilities, and I don't know what those facilities are.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative Hurtas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hines, I believe that the 4D property classification, I think the tenants in these apartments are eligible for property tax renters credit or rent refund, is that correct?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, they would, residents in a low-income apartment would still be eligible for the PTR, yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think, you know, what we have done with the property tax system is to try to target that relief with direct aids or payments through renters credit and property tax refunds. So I share a little bit of the concerns that Representative Loeffler mentioned about, you know, how this would affect a lot of properties across the state and how the shifting of that goes to other taxpayers. So the relief really is given to the end user in terms of renter's credit based on their income circumstance, and those who wouldn't qualify would obviously pay a higher rent.
Well, I would beg the question, Representative Hertas and Mr. Hines, should we repeal those other two exemptions in order to put them all in the same field? Anyway, no answer needed, but it's certainly a good question in that situation. Other questions, members? Anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Mr. May, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May, representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Every year we prepare a legislative statement of our positions. And on that position statement, one of the items is MAO supports good tax policy that treats all taxpayers in a consistent manner. MAAO opposes classifications or programs that target only a small number of taxpayers. Normally in exemptions, it does target just a small number of taxpayers. I might add at this point that under our 27202 subdivision or statute, which is our exemption statute, we currently have 101 subdivisions. So that's 101 different types of exemptions that we currently have. Subdivision 7 is purely public charity. And if the facility qualifies as a purely public charity, and there's a lengthy explanation under Subdivision 7 that itemizes these, they certainly can qualify for exemption. In fact, we have a committee that sits at the Department of Revenue. It has members from the Department of Revenue, MAAO, and the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits that look at these exemption questions. If they're a question that the county can't answer, they can appeal to that group to determine whether or not they really truly are a purely public charity. In this case, I don't know if they've pursued the purely public charity area for a 27203. I'm not familiar with that, but those would be my comments. And so with that, MAO would oppose any additional exemption in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. May. Questions for Mr. May? Anyone else would like to testify on this bill? Hearing none. Representative Schultz, any other questions?
Yes, I would just like comments? To make some comments. So in your packet, you should have letters from the mayor of Duluth, city council members, and county commissioners supporting this exemption. And I also want to note that this facility is very unique because it doesn't force residents out if they can't pay their rent. And 40% of the beds are for very low-income senior citizens. And so my fear is if this facility does not get this tax exemption, it will close and will increase the burden on the state to house these individuals in a nursing home or more expensive facility. And many may even go homeless. So as a legislature, we're trying to address homelessness in Minnesota. I urge you to support this legislation and be consistent with the other two facilities that have received the exemption or take action to group them in a different category. And I believe just reading the Minnesota Department of Revenue statutory guidelines for exemption, that this facility meets those guidelines as a 501c3. It's supported by donations, gifts, and a lot of volunteer hours to operate this facility. It also make sure that a material number of recipients receive benefits or services at reduced cost, and that there would be an increased burden providing these services if this facility would close. And then the last requirement that it is to the benefits are received by a restricted class of individuals being senior citizens. So please look at my bill carefully and look at what's been done in the past for these unique facilities. I don't think we have that many in the state that would qualify, so I don't have that same fear that a lot of assisted living facilities would come forward, because many of those assisted living facilities do not have as many beds for low-income senior citizens and don't provide the same level of support services that St. Anne's does. And again, thank you for hearing the bill, and I appreciate your willingness to hear the bill and asking questions.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Mr. Johnson, quickly, have you applied for that exemption from the institution of, is it Pure Charity?
We started this process locally, and we applied with St. Louis County for a tax exemption. We were denied based on the law regarding nursing homes and boarding care. We appealed, and that appeal has been sitting unanswered by our local assessor for a year, which brought us to this point.
Okay.
If I may, Mr. From what I understand of the committee that exists for the pure charity component and applying that way, that the county assessor, from what I understand, can ask for that to occur for us as well. So that does not have to come from the facility, from what I understand.
Thank you. With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 2956 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Schultz and Mr. Johnson. Representative Keel, have you, is your meeting, you're still have your meeting going on? Okay. Representative Gruenhagen, if it's okay, we'll have Representative Keel. She's got to go back and chair her committee, if that's okay. Representative Keel, welcome to the Property Tax Committee. Representative Anderson moves that House File 2909 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have some, if the page could hand these out. Thank you. Good morning, members, and thank you very much for hearing this bill. House File 2909, Mr. Chair and committee members, is seeking the renewal and of a local levy authority for Minnesota, Northwest Minnesota Multicultural HRA. This would be the second extension of this limited levy authority, which is supported by all the counties that participate in the HRA. The legislature has authorized Northwest Minnesota Multi-County HRA to levy one-fourth of its statutory levy authority without going back to each of the counties for their sign-off. Typically, an HRA has a single jurisdiction, a city or a county, with whom to interact for approval of their levy. In this case, Northwest Minnesota Multicultural HRA would spend the whole lot of time going county by county to annually receive approval, and they would be spending a lot of time and money on this administration function and less time on their underlying mission to address housing needs in the region. With me today is Mr. Lee Meyer, and the executive director of the HRA. He can tell you about the relationship with the counties and their support for this limited levy authority for the HRA. Once Mr. Meyer has testified, if you have any questions. Okay.
Thanks, Representative Keogh. Mr. Meyer, welcome. Please introduce yourself to the record and proceed, sir.
My name is Lee Meyer. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Minnesota Multi-County HRA in Metro Minnesota. I got a little prepared comments and then just a few more comments in the end, and we'll open up for questions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as I stated, my name is Lee Meyer. I'm the director of the Northwest Minnesota Multi-County HRA. Representative Keel has captured the essence of what we are trying to accomplish with this bill. We are really maintaining the status quo with respect to the levy authority for our multi-county HRA. The legislature first authorized this approach in 2008. There was a sunset established at that time for 5 years and came back to the legislature and demonstrated the process was working for the counties, and they supported the approach. And a second five-year authorization was enacted. Things have continued to work well. The counties continue to be on board, and we are asking for another five-year authorization, which will allow us to levy one-fourth of statutory limit for the HRA. I have materials that we handed out, and just to kind of give you an overview, the first couple of pages, once was kind of a comment, the next page is a map of the HRA. The six counties are highlighted in yellow. And then after that, there's support letters from our HRA Board of Commissioners, and then the six counties also supported it. And just to let you know that all six counties were unanimous in their support. And then we have from some private business, a few support letters, and also from nonprofits and cities throughout the region. The levy has been used, and I mean, to the benefit of all six counties, so it's been distributed. And then the last four pages, just it's a list of different projects that we've been involved in and how the HRA levy leveraged funds for those communities. And we continue to do that, and we also do housing rehab, assist with some small loans to like homeowners or businesses that need that extra little bit of capital to make their deal work. So that's kind of a general overview. So if you have any questions or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Questions? Representative Hurtbus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel or the testifier, you've got six counties that are part of this multi-housing redevelopment authority. Do you have any approximate estimate? What is the total estimated market value in this political subdivision?
Mr. Meyer?
I believe it's about $1.3 million. I don't have it here exactly. And then so what the HRA ends up getting as far as 25%, if our HRA board chooses to do that, is a little over $400,000 a year at this point.
Representative Hurtas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm struggling with some of those numbers, but thanks.
Other questions, members? Anyone else would like Representative New?
Thank you, Chair Drozdowski. Just quickly, when this was initially formed, was this approved by the counties at the time, or did this ever have a voter referendum as well?
Mr. Meyer.
We've had some three of the counties that approved the levy prior to the HRA levy. Mm-hmm. And so for those counties, and all the counties were on board initially to move forward with this, because it gave the HRA board some flexibility, and they felt that they understood what the need was and they could act on it.
Representative New?
Thank you.
So, Mr. Meyer, what describe the initial, when this was initially passed in 2008, what was the compelling reason then to do this?
Well, the main reason, like I stated, was, in order to have funds available if we want to apply for a small cities grant, for a housing grant or wherever, to Minnesota Housing Finance or DEED, they always look for leverage. And so this gave us the ability to come forward with some leverage, some levy dollars, so we could leverage dollars to get additional funding. And also with the kind of move where the federal government was kind of decreasing some of the subsidies that were coming out, this gave us more flexibility to bring funds into the region. And we just wanted the opportunity, with the tax dollars, and then the locals had the input on should we do it or shouldn't we, and then the benefit would remain locally. So all the revenue that's collected, we keep it separate for each county. So the dollars that come in from Kitson County stay with Kitson County and so forth.
So, thank you, Mr. Meyer. So, Mr. Meyer, it was written with a sunset to begin with. Evidently the thought was at the time that, this was kind of a temporary thing, and then the sunset was extended again, and now we're looking to extend it again. Can you comment on why? It appears to be more of it's kind of morphed from a temporary need to a permanent need.
Yeah. Somebody had mentioned about maybe instead of coming back every 5 years to go to 10, but our comment was that if we go with a 5, that way you have an end period. So if we aren't doing what we're supposed to be doing and the funds aren't being used the way they should and they aren't generating additional capital, that it could end. And that's why we do the sunset. And then we go back to see if the counties believe this was a good thing, if the tax dollars were spent well, and then we look for another 5 years to continue that process. And it's worked well in the past years. It's generated, like you can see in there, a little over $6 for every dollar invested. $6 come in additional funding, And also our goal is when we increase, when we bring in money for rehab or work with redevelopment with a business, that when they get those funds, it'll increase the tax base. So that's what they look at also.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the testifier, talking about the HRI board, how large is it, and are there county commissioners on that board?
Mr. Meyer?
Yes. We have one commissioner for each county. They're appointed by the county commissioners, and right now we have two county commissioners that serve on the board out of six, and four are non-county commissioners, and they serve for a five-year term.
Representative Anderson. Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As an insurance agent in my real life, I deal a lot with HRAs, insuring them and working with them. And without exception, in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, found them to be very budget conscious and constantly looking for input for ways to improve from outside. Now, I've never worked with yours, but the it's a great mechanism for keeping people in their community. And the some of the things that HUD requires from a budgeting standpoint, I question. I think if we allowed more latitude to them, but the 5-year sunset actually causes accountability. Just like the testifier said, I've got to come in and demonstrate that we're doing good things. Otherwise, we have the right to vote this down. So I like that provision. I support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Luna. Now, did anybody else like to comment or questions? Did anybody else want to testify on this bill? Hearing none, Representative Keel, you want to wrap it up?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is very helpful to our northwest corner of Minnesota to help people work there, but more importantly live there, and advances their businesses at some points. And we're really in need of housing, workforce housing, because we have the jobs. But we got to have a place for people to live, and a lot of it is that workforce housing that we have needs for. So I thank you very much, and I hope you support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Keel. With that, Representative Anderson removes his motion. The House File 2909 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative New moves that House File 2834 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Grunhagen, welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing this bill. This bill originated from a constituent of mine, a CPA, who contacted me, and we had a nonprofit organization, this time a church, that was willing to open a daycare in our local community. As you're aware, daycare access for working parents and low-income parents is at a crisis in many parts of the state. That's also true, of course, in my district. What they found out and is that because the facility was detached from the church, it was assessed property taxes. So if they would have opened a daycare facility attached to the church, there'd be no property taxes. But because they opened it in a facility detached from the church, they had property taxes. And as we know, paying for daycare by parents is a hardship in many cases. And when a additional property tax is assessed on the facility, it's passed along to the parents. I have with me, Mr. Chair, Katie Rickert, the director. There's also a packet in your that's being handed out, Precious Little Blessings packet that gives you additional information. I would especially direct you to the items 1 through 4 at the bottom of the page. And I did receive a fiscal note on this, and from the department, and it was zero. So there is no fiscal note on it. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to have my testifier make comments.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, and welcome, Ms. Rickert. If you would introduce yourself for the record and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Katie Rickert. I am the director of Precious Little Blessings Daycare here in Glencoe. We are licensed for 16 infants, 14 toddlers, and 20 preschoolers, 50 children total. Currently, we have 45 full-time children, and we have started a wait list. Since opening May 2016, we have reached 110 children. We accept low-income families, the CCAP, which is Child Care Assistance Program. We have reached 12 children on that program. We accept any county. We have served Scott, McLeod, and Nicollet County. Referencing to the handout, our church members have borrowed $80,000 to fund the startup of Precious Little Blessings Daycare, and they've raised and donated $57,000 to continue this mission. There is such a great need for child care in rural Minnesota, and in Glencoe alone, there's been many home daycares that continue to close down day after day, and so many people are seeking child care. If our daycare was attached to the church, we wouldn't get property taxed. But since we are detached, we are getting property tax, and the pay does get passed on to the parents. So we still have the same mission, even though we are detached, and I think we should be exempt from it. So thank you for your time, and if there's any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rickard. Questions for Ms. Rickard or the author? Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. And it's more a comment, just this bill and Representative Schultz's bill are very similar. I think they're both doing really good things, and we want to reduce the tax burden, I think, on the elderly facilities and these child cares. But I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, as we're considering these bills, I know we're laying them over, if and maybe nonpartisan staff can help us with this, there are ways to do this that actually wouldn't increase the complexity of our property tax system. And, you know, I don't particularly like it whenever we do really specific carve-outs, but I do want to help. So I just wanted to put that out there for the committee and thank Representative for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I agree, too, that this is a great thing for Glencoe. And just a question, your handout says it's a Christian-based daycare operated by the church. If it is in fact owned by the church, wouldn't that automatically give you the status?
Representative Gruenhagen?
Yeah, I visited with the assessor and at length, and because it's detached under the current statutes, it's not. It is subject to property taxes, even if it's owned by a nonprofit church. If it was attached to the church building, it would be exempt from property taxes. So it seems a little strange, but I think with the crisis in daycare that we see across the state, we should not be penalizing nonprofits for stepping up to meet this need. And I'm sure regardless of it's metro or rural, you're experiencing this same problem, you know, in terms of access for parents for the daycare.
Representative Anderson? Other questions, members? Mr. May, would you like to talk about the bill? Welcome, Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I would say my comments will be identical to what they were on House File 2956. And MAO would oppose this bill as being very specifically carved out for a special use, but we really don't know what the impact statewide could be. It may be very significant.
Thank you, Mr. May. Mr. May, do you have any ideas on how, is there any other approach that Representative Gruenhagen could take? Obviously, the spirit of many on the committee are sympathetic to what Representative Gruenhagen's bringing forward. Is there another way rather than an exemption? Is there a way to, you know, the fact that it's operated by the church? Probably not, because it's not attached. I mean, this it's not property specific. But any ideas you have?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that and I don't know what they mean by detached from the church. I don't know if it's on this church property or if it's two blocks away or what it might be. But I'm not sure the issue is just attached or detached, because even if it's attached to the church, if it operates in a manner that it's not a purely public charity, it's going to be taxable and it'll be a subrecord. So I'm not sure that detachment or non-attachment is the issue here. I think it might be more or less where the property is located and what its use is and how it operates. So I could check into that for you, and I'd be glad to do that.
Could you work with Representative Gruenhagen, try to help us see if we can find a different approach that doesn't do this special carve-out?
I could certainly do that, Mr. Chair.
Awesome. Thank you, Mr. May. Other questions, members of Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it does raise some of the same questions about whether we should have a broad exemption for certain types of facilities rather than do it exception by exception. And I kind of like not doing – if we have 101 exemptions, maybe we end up with 500 if we're not careful. But I did note in this packet that has the colorful front page that there's a letter from the Department of Revenue that said that it would potentially be covered as a purely public charity, except that they needed to provide additional documentation to the Department of Revenue. And I'm wondering if they did provide that additional information or if that's still a process that might resolve this.
Ms. Rickert or Representative Gruenhagen?
Yeah, I could just add a little bit, and maybe Ms. Rickert could comment too. The Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, they basically in visiting with the local assessor in regards to this letter, she stated that if they held a Sunday school class in there, if they held church meetings in there, if they did anything church-related in that detached facility, then it would probably qualify for an exemption. And so that's the technicality that we're dealing with here. So,
Ms. Rickert?
We are fulfilling our mission that the church has provided and sharing the word of Jesus with the children. We do it every day, the religious activities. So I feel like we should qualify for exemption.
So where's the disconnect? Representative Loeffler, maybe you have a follow-up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, I mean, is it incorporated as a nonprofit or is it operating as a profit-based enterprise that happens to be located in a church facility, even if it has a religious aspect to it? I mean, is that an issue? We're all still learning, trying to figure out how these get interpreted.
Mr. Hines, do you have any insight for us?
Mr. Chair, I don't really. I'm as kind of as curious as the rest of you about the statement that says if the organization wishes to pursue further an exemption, additional documentation must be provided, and wondering what that documentation is and what's the holdup there. Because it sounds like they've applied through the Public Charity Board, and the Board has at least made some indications of a favorable ruling. I can't answer the question.
Ms. Rickert, are you still pursuing this with the Public Charity Board, or are you still on the phone with them?
Mr. Chair, not to my knowledge, I feel like we submitted all the information that we could.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the Tim Schultz, the CPA who originally contacted me on this, said that they had provided additional documentation and that they were declined, although they were advised that if they went to tax court, they'd probably win. But we know how much it costs to go to tax court, okay? And so I do believe if you look at the date of the letter, February 15, 2017, I was contacted during the late summer or fall of 2017, so they had already pursued this, to my knowledge, in discussion with the Tim Schuth, and were not able to work out an agreement at that time. And I did visit with the local county assessor, Sue Schultz, and she was firm that under current statute that the property tax had to apply because it wasn't either on church, right next to the church, or attached to church attached to the church.
Thank you. Other questions, members?
State General Levy's on here, too.
Okay. With that, Representative Gruenhagen, any final comments that you might have? Anyone else like to testify for this?
Members, I'm more than happy to work to see if we have an alternative way that's more appealing to the committee and rather than an outright exemption. However, I think we all know the crisis of daycare right now and the burden of the cost on parents' low income. And to add to that, rather than with property tax penalty, on a nonprofit that's trying to step up and meet the need at a time where we see more and more individual daycare facilities closing and less opportunity. And as Director Rickert said, they have a waiting list and they serve a multiple of counties. So think how far parents drive just to bring their child to that daycare. So I think this is a way we can help facilitate that and maybe other nonprofits would actually step out. And as far as cost, I've never known a fiscal note to be wrong, so mine is zero.
It's a revenue note.
A revenue note, yeah.
Okay. With that, Representative, thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. Thank you, Ms. Rickert. With that, Representative New, renews her motion that House File 2834 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Member.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. Members, with that, I believe we're adjourned.